So my name is Lindsay Brian Podvin. I'm a behavioral health consultant and social worker with the University of Michigan, and I work with the MC3 program, the Michigan Child Collaborative Care Program. And I kind of split my time between working at a pediatrician's office a couple days a week and working as a liaison between pediatricians and child and adolescent psychiatrists. So I'm so excited to be here tonight and talk about something that I'm very passionate about, and I'm excited to hear your questions as we move on. So tonight we're going to just discuss what is depression, make sure that everyone has a good understanding of what it is and especially what it isn't. And especially during these teenage years, it's very important to differentiate the difference between normal teenage moodiness and clinical depression. So we're going to spend some time talking about that. Additionally, we're going to talk about resiliency, how to create it in your teens, how to support it in your teens, and how to emphasize positive coping skills to help not only with depression, but just teenagehood in general. So first, I just want to start out with some numbers. Depression is super, super common, and it's also very common in our youth. About 11 to 14% of our teenagers will experience depression throughout that point in time. And females are 2 to 3 times more likely than males to experience a major depressive episode. And this is really important because suicide is the second leading cause of death for our teens and for our young adults. So we want to make sure that we take seriously when a child or a teen comes to us and shares their concerns of depression. We want to make sure that we can help address those concerns. And depression certainly has a lot of effects on the person and on the family, but when we take a step back and we look at depression from a societal perspective, there are huge costs associated with depression. So it's associated with a reduced quality in life. We know that it tends to go hand in hand with other risk factors. Personal earnings and household income of people with depression are considerably lower than those without depression. This may be because when they're at work, they're not quite as productive as their non-depressed cohorts, or it may be because they're missing work. They're not able to physically get there. They're not able to function. So when we're getting ready to send our teens out to community college or on to work or to university, we want to make sure that their mental health is addressed so they can become successful, functioning members of society and be able to be, you know, successful in and of itself. Depression is linked to these other chronic health conditions. We know that there tends to be a little link between things like depression and arthritis, asthma, cancer, hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, and chronic pain. So depression doesn't just exist by itself. It often kind of coexists with a lot of other things. So these also may be associated with or risk factors for depression. So speaking specifically about teens, teenagehood is a really tough time. There's a lot going on. I can see quite a few adolescents in the crowd. There are so many things going on. You've got an increased desire for teens to be accepted by their peers. You have this increased time to try and fit in and belong. And then you have this brain that's kind of in overactive mode. And we've got these hormone developments and all this dopamine flowing through, and their prefrontal cortex isn't quite developed. So we've got this kind of recipe for teenagers to take bigger risks and also to have a really aroused reward center. So this little quote helps to kind of put it into place. So the combination of an easily aroused reward center and a slow to mature self-regulation system contributes to a lot of risky behavior. So you add on teenagehood with anything else, and we've got a lot going on that we want to make sure to be cognizant of when we're working with our teens and our adolescents. So there are three big components to depression, and if you take away anything from tonight, what I really want to make clear is that depression isn't always the stereotype of what we imagine it to be. It may be a person who is tearful and in their bed and unable to function. However, depression is much more diverse than often we imagine it to be. So I want to make sure that while we're talking about some of those stereotypical things we think about when it comes to depression, that we're also kind of broadening our horizons and understanding that it actually does look pretty different from person to person. So there's three kind of big areas in which depression affects us. It's our cognitive area, it's our emotional area, and then also our feelings or our behaviors or our actions. So some cognitive symptoms of depression are having a hard time functioning, having an inability to concentrate. In my work at the pediatrician's office, oftentimes I'll see teens present saying things like, oh, I just can't pay attention, I can't focus, I think I have ADHD, and we'll kind of go through everything, and it becomes pretty clear that it's not ADHD, but they are ticking quite a few boxes for depression. So that's something to be mindful for. Other cognitive symptoms are seeing only the negative, so only seeing the bad things that happen, dwelling on the things that aren't good, that aren't right. Having anxious or racing thoughts is really prevalent when we have depression. And thoughts of death, dying, and suicide are also symptoms that may be associated with depression. When it comes to our emotional symptoms of depression, feeling worthless, guilty, or hopeless can be a big warning sign. So feeling like they're not worth something, or feeling, you know, if your kid keeps coming to you and saying things like, oh, you just don't get it, you don't care, I'm not worth anything, those are kind of some things that we want to take seriously. Loss of pleasure or enjoyment, and this kind of goes along with a sense of loneliness and isolation. Oftentimes with our teens, it can be pretty tough to suss out whether or not they're having enjoyment in their activities. They're, you know, in drama club one night, they're going to a football game Saturday, they're busy, they're going, they're always with their friends, and when we look at them, we're going, well, they're hanging out with everyone, they're having fun, they're doing everything that a normal teen is supposed to be doing. How could my child be depressed? Well, what we often see is that these kids are really good at kind of putting on this mask, and even though they're around all their friends, even though they're doing things that they're supposed to enjoy or supposed to like, they don't feel it. They feel lonely and isolated even when they're surrounded by kind of fun activities. So that's something to really be mindful of, is are they actually enjoying those activities that they're going to? Are they getting any pleasure out of it? And along with that loneliness and isolation, there may be some actual isolation. They may not want to come out of their room. They may not want to see their friends. And a big one is irritability or short temper. Oftentimes, along with the kids who come into my office saying things like, oh, I can't pay attention, it'll be like, oh, everything gets under my skin. My mom drives me crazy. My little brother's making me mad. And it's not just this one or two kind of days of having a bad day, not getting along with mom, not getting along with dad. It's this chronic, consistent irritability. We often hear parents and siblings of family members who have somebody in their family with depression say things like, it feels like we're walking on eggshells around them. We're not really sure what's going to set them off today. And depression is also quite physical. We can feel really ill. In other cultures, they often don't refer to depression as depression. They say, oh, I'm really achy, I'm really sick, I'm really not doing well, which in our culture we might call depression. So there can be changes in sleep pattern. And again, this is where that kind of either or can come into play when it comes to depression. This might be a person who's sleeping all the time, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and then they get up and they're still groggy. They don't really feel rested. Or it could be the flip of that. You've got someone who goes to bed at 10 and they're wide awake, tossing and turning until 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning and they can't sleep. Or they finally fall asleep for a couple hours only to wake up wide awake later. So we've got this kind of hypersomnia, insomnia, and it might not be always the same. It might be a couple weeks of sleeping a ton and not feeling rested, and it might be a couple days of being really anxious and unable to relax and unable to sleep. Change in appetite is also really common with depression, and it may be related to this sleep piece and when it comes to depression. When it comes to eating too much, what we know is when we don't have good quality sleep, we're lacking some energy. And how does our body get energy? It craves things that are going to give it that burst of energy quickly, things like chips and candy and soda. So if you find that your kid is only going towards the junk food and they're not sleeping a ton, it might be time to ask them a couple other questions about what might be going on. On the flip side of that, they might not have an appetite at all. I'm not really hungry for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. They kind of pick at their food. They just don't have it in them to eat. They may be feeling really restless and have increased movement. So you might see them fidgeting a little bit more than usual, having a hard time sitting still. This kind of comes from that underlying maybe anxiety or anxious thoughts that might be running through. And on the flip of that, they might be moving really slowly. They might feel really sluggish. Their speech might be slowed. Their actions might be slowed. For a lot of people, like I mentioned earlier, they physically don't feel well. They have aches, they have pains, they're sore, they're uncomfortable. And additionally, we have a lot of stomach concerns that can be associated with depression, things like diarrhea, constipation, stomach aches. That also comes up a lot when I see my kids in the pediatrician's office. So if you guys are looking at this and going, well, that's every teen on the planet. Every teen is irritable. Every teen only wants junk food, and every teen doesn't want to go to sleep. I really want you to focus on the chronicity of their depression. How long has it been lasting, and how much is it impacting their functioning? It's normal for a teen, sorry to say, to storm away from mom or dad and slam the door. I hate your guts. That's teenage behavior. Sorry. But if it's happening all the time, day after day, doesn't matter if it's you, their brother, their boyfriend, their girlfriend, their friends, they're constantly irritated. They're constantly frustrated. Things don't seem to be good enough. They might have had a great day, and then somebody didn't text them back right when they said they would. And then all of a sudden, the world is over. It's the end of the world. It's how intense is it, and how long is it lasting? And then on top of that, how is it impacting their functioning? Is it making them hard? Is it making it hard for them to get to school? Are their grades dropping? Are they usually an A, B student and suddenly they're a C, D student? Is it that they don't want to go to practice anymore? Maybe they're involved in theater and they stop showing up for rehearsals and for practices. Is it impacting their functioning? Maybe they've got a part-time job and they've been calling in sick a lot, and we don't really think there's anything physically going on with them. So how much is it impacting their functioning? You can be a moody teen and get by just fine. If you have depression, it's much more difficult to function and to focus and to push through everything that you're dealing with. So these are some kind of phrases that you may hear from a depressed teen. So I mentioned earlier, you know, I just feel so lazy, I feel tired, I sleep all day, and I just don't feel rested. That's a concern. Even when good things happen, I don't feel happy. I just feel numb. Those are things we want to be worried about. I don't feel like myself. I feel worthless. Nothing is fun anymore. You know, so these are the kinds of things that we want to pay attention to when our teens say things like this. And I want to also be clear that these might be things that they say when something bad happens. Say they do have a breakup. Say they do get into a fight with their friend. They might be saying things like this, but how long is it lasting? So kind of piggybacking off of what I last said, using the right language when we're speaking about depression. Clinical depression is not a fleeting mood. It's not a bad day. It is something that is with you. So if you lose your keys, you might be agitated. You're not depressed. If you're going on a first date, you might be nervous. You're not depressed. So you can kind of see how using the right language helps us when somebody comes to us and they're in pain and they're hurting and they want something, actually hearing what they're saying and making sure we're not making light of what they're going through. The first ones are all different responses, and the last one is there's nothing necessary to make somebody depressed. You don't have to have something bad happen to you. It can just happen. And there's many, many reasons why it might happen, but you don't have to have a root cause to have depression. So what do we do for depression? We've got a lot of great ways to treat depression, and many people with depression go on to be in recovery or remission or whatever language you would like to use. So cognitive behavioral therapy is the one that you're going to hear again and again and again. And that is an evidence-based type of psychotherapy that looks at how our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors are all connected. So a depressed teen may fail their test in algebra and think, oh my goodness, I failed my test, I'm never going to pass this class. If I never pass this class, then I'm not going to pass this grade, and I'm going to be fail out of school, and then I'm going to be stuck in my mom's basement for the rest of my life. And if that's going to happen, then I'm just not going to leave this weekend because I don't want to hang out with anyone because I'm miserable and I'm basically flipping burgers for the rest of my life. So you can see how that thought spiral can contribute to the way that somebody feels and the way they think, and then their reaction may be pulling back. So what cognitive behavioral therapy does is it takes that thought and it helps that person look at it through a lens of clarity. Yes, you did fail your test, and you have two more tests to go. And your teacher said, stop by after class and ask me for help. And you can get some tutoring. And just one failed class doesn't mean the rest of your life is over. So then you have that kind of framework around that thought. And then the feeling is, yeah, I'm still feeling a little down. I'm still feeling a little crappy. But you know what? I'll go to the football game tonight with my friends, get my mind off of it. So you can see how cognitive behavioral therapy helps you to look at it through a lens of clarity. Meditation, yoga, mindfulness are all incredibly important. I know through a lot of different school systems, we've incorporated things like mindful breathing and yoga poses, and it's become very helpful. And kids today are so much more game to do stuff like this. You know, 15, 20 years ago, if you would have said yoga or mindfulness, I don't know where you guys are from, but everyone would have rolled their eyes and walked away. So I'm so thankful now that we're in a period of time where people are open to this and understand that it does work. Exercise is incredibly important. What we know is that not doing anything and not moving doesn't really do much for your mood. So getting out and exercising, specifically 3 to 5 times a week, really getting your heart rate up, really sweating, is incredibly beneficial. It helps to release those endorphins. It helps to get that dopamine going. It can help you so you sleep better at night. And what we know about exercise is it kind of is this test run for resilience. You know, you don't go into the gym and lift, you know, deadlift 300 pounds right away. You don't go into the gym and run 10 miles right away. You start small, and you might be a little sore, you might be a little uncomfortable, but you get better. And so what exercise helps to do for your mind is almost what it helps to do for your body. It helps your body to get stronger, to become more resilient, and to show yourself that you're capable of this, you can do this. And so that's really beneficial for our mind as well. Sleep is huge. If I could talk about anything forever and ever, it would be sleep. I have struggled with poor sleep, and I can't tell you how amazing it is to get a good night's sleep and feel like a new person. I'm sure that we've all had those nights where we toss and turn and don't sleep, and if you haven't, God bless you. You're very fortunate. But you can imagine when, you know, a toddler doesn't get his or her nap or isn't able to sleep through the night very well. What are they like the next day? They're cranky. They're crabby. They're crying. They are irritable. They can't focus. They can't pay attention. Well, guess what? That's what happens to us adults and us teens as well. When we don't get good sleep, we can't focus. We can't concentrate. It makes things easier to get under our skin. And when we have depression, our sleep gets kind of messed up, and then that messed up sleep contributes to worsening symptoms of depression. So it's so important to hone in on good quality sleep. We can talk a little bit about sleep hygiene, but Google it. It's essentially the same thing as, you know, oral hygiene or body hygiene. It's making sure that you treat your sleep with respect, if that makes sense, and make sure that you're doing things that are appropriate for your body by getting that good quality rest. Other things that you can do, the clinical term is behavioral activation. It really means just doing stuff, doing good, happy stuff. So the difference between kind of a negative behavior activation or positive behavior activation would be something that gives that person joy or meaning or excitement or peace. So, you know, having a mug of tea and flipping through a magazine, that's behavioral activation, believe it or not. Calling a friend or texting a friend when you're feeling down, that's behavioral activation. Going out for a bike ride, behavioral activation. Getting out, doing something, and being kind to yourself. And finally, medication. We know that SSRIs and SNRIs can be very beneficial for folks who have depression. What we know the evidence shows is that a combination of medication plus cognitive behavioral therapy is the most effective treatment for depression. If you don't like medication, if you're not interested in that, the next best thing, the next most effective thing is cognitive behavioral therapy. So just something to keep in mind. So what is resilience? Resilience is the ability of somebody to bounce back when things go poorly. And how can we help to create resiliency in our youth? Warmth from parents, warmth from caregivers, showing your child, your teen, that you're listening to them, that you believe them, that you trust them, having good relationships with peers, having a strong sense of self-efficacy. So self-efficacy is the ability to believe in your own beliefs, the ability, I think I can and I will, and having emotional self-regulation, which often does come with time. And positive coping skills are things that a person can do to deal with a stressful situation. And this helps to create resilience. And we want to focus on positive coping skills because negative coping skills, things like drinking and drugging, often are only temporary fixes. And more often than not, they're actually quite dangerous. So we don't want to be relying on those negative coping skills. So this is just a little kind of brainstorm of things that you can do that don't have to be super intense that can help with not just depression, but also just teenagehood in general. Being active is really important. Mindfulness, positive self-talk. One of my favorite things on here is the last one. It's actually volunteering. We know that teens are incredibly empathic. And when we get them in a situation where they can give back, that gives them so much empowerment and it helps them to take a step back and see what's going on in their world that is good, that is positive. So volunteering is one of my favorite things to recommend for teens who have depression. And it's a great thing to do together as a family. Nice little family bonding time. So what can parents do? What can caregivers do? Modeling positive coping skills consistently is really important. So this can be, you know, you come home from a long day of work. Instead of slamming the door and saying, nobody talk to me and running away, maybe saying something like, hon, I need 10 minutes. I need just 10 minutes. Go, do your thing. Calm, calm, very important. And then come back. What did you just show your kid? You showed your kid, one, it's okay to be upset. There's nothing wrong with having a bad day. Two, you showed your kid how to deal with it in a way that's appropriate. I'm going to pull away so I don't snap on somebody for a few minutes, and then I'm going to come back and join everyone. Adults can give themselves timeouts, and it's lovely. Creating opportunities for teens to contribute to others, that goes along with volunteering. And it kind of ties into demonstrating the importance of community. It's so important for teens to feel like they belong and feel like they have somewhere to go. So helping them find, what is their community? Is it a theater troupe? Is it a volunteer group? Is it a sports club? Is it a chess club? What is it that they can hold on to and find other people who are like-minded and they can feel like they belong? Foster healthy relationships. This is really important too. It's making sure that the people that you keep around yourself and the people you bring into your house are healthy relationships for you. So those people in our lives who might be like really toxic, really dramatic, there's always something terrible going on with them, maybe saying, you know what, I'm going to take a break from that person, and showing your child that the world does not end when you cut somebody out of your life who's not good for you. Avoiding comparisons between others. So this one's huge, especially siblings, sibling rivalry, especially Timmy across the street. You know, why couldn't you do this like so-and-so? Really, really harmful. So right when you feel like that's coming on, maybe give yourself an adult timeout and think about something else that you might be able to say. Teens are already on high alert of who's looking at me, who's judging me, what am I doing wrong? So comparing them to anybody else just adds on to that pressure. Finally, listening without lecturing. So when a kid comes in and says, oh my gosh, I had a bad day, oftentimes parents want to go, oh my gosh, let me tell you what to do. Let me get you to fix this. What can I do? Pause for a second. Just say, that sucks you had a bad day. I'm sorry that happened. Tell me about it. Give them a second to respond. Oftentimes we want to fix, we want to fix, we want to fix. And how we create resilience in our teens is showing them how to problem solve, showing them how to fix their own problems, and giving them that time that they need. Teen brains take a little bit longer to process things, too. So when they walk in the door and you go, how was your day? What'd you learn? Who'd you see? They rightfully are going to be very frustrated with you. So maybe pause on that, too. Let them come to you. Let them say what's going on. And acknowledging mistakes. Nobody is perfect. Nobody is going to bounce through life with beautiful coping skills, rose-colored glasses every single day. Again, creating resilience shows your teen that it's okay to make a mistake and it's okay to fix it and move on. That's the beauty of resiliency. So I touched on this a little bit earlier when I was speaking about listening without lecturing, but this is a little example of why it's really important. One, it gives teens a second to pause and think about the question that you've asked and give them a second to respond. And it demonstrates that you understand them, you respect them, you do want to hear what they have to say. You don't just want to fix everything for them. So if somebody comes home and says, hey, I'm feeling really sad today, it can be as simple as saying, you're feeling really sad today. I know that sounds really cheesy and very therapeutic, but there's a reason we do it in therapy because it's really helpful. Or just say, you're feeling down. That's tough. Pause. It's going to feel like a million and one seconds. It's really not that long. Pause. Bite your tongue for a second. Demonstrate that resiliency. So what are some little terms that you can use? So the ones on the right might be the ones that either we have jumped to or our child's peers have jumped to or neighbors have jumped to. You know, nobody in this room has jumped to these words. But what helps versus what hurts? So I might not be able to understand exactly what you're going through, but I want to try. I want to help. Versus, it's all in your head. We all go through this. Get over it. You know, those are very, very different responses to somebody saying, I'm having a tough time. If somebody says to you that they're feeling suicidal, instead of saying something like, you're too young to think about dying, you've got a lot going on for you, those are nice things to say. However, saying, your life is important to me, just feels a little bit nicer. So when a kid comes home, they had a bad day, here's what to do. This is the next step. How about just, all right, I'm here to listen. I know your feelings are real. That is really important. Even if you might think you would feel differently or you might react in a different way, what that person is expressing to you is what they are feeling. So just acknowledging, I hear you. This is tough. I know what you're saying is what you're feeling. That's it. Doesn't have to be super fancy. So before we switch over to our Q&A section, I just want to make sure that I've drilled home that depression is really common, especially in youth. It's really treatable, and early interventions and developing coping skills can be incredibly beneficial tools to help you and your teen create resilience.
Yeah, so I'm Meg Jennings. I'm the social work supervisor at Regional Alliance for Healthy Schools, and I'm a social worker and have about 9 years of experience working with youth who are struggling with depression and anxiety, primarily in a therapy context, is my experience. And
I'm Nicole Speck. I'm a nurse practitioner and the clinical manager of Regional Alliance for Healthy Schools. It's part of the Community Health Services Program with Michigan Medicine, which most of you know is a university in Michigan. I treat a lot of teens with anxiety and depression, and I am a mom of a teenager.
Hello, everyone. My name is Craig Van Kempen. I'm with the Corner Health Center. For those who don't know, the Corner Health Center is an adolescent healthcare clinic located in Ypsilanti. We serve exclusively 12 to 25-year-olds and their children if they have any. And my job there, I have two. I'm a clinical social worker, as well as I am the health educator for our theater troupe peer education program, which brings out a depression awareness play to local schools to start that conversation and talk to people about it.
So we've got a few questions here, and any of you guys are welcome to answer these. So one is, can you compare depression with anxiety? And I might also add, can you compare and contrast that? So if any of you guys want to take that.
I can start. Depression and anxiety many times are comorbid. They coexist and they happen at the same time. Sometimes their symptoms overlap. And they're sometimes very much treated the same way with the same medications. A lot of times with SSRIs, if you decide to do that, treatment is also very effective with anxiety disorders just as it is in depression. But it can present in very different ways. For anxiety, there's symptoms of panic, having your heart race. Sometimes it can mimic other things that a teen might say that's going on, such as shortness of breath, feeling like their heart is racing, or maybe they think they're having an asthma attack when really it's a panic attack. So sometimes there can be some very physical symptoms of anxiety.
Okay. What to do when your teen refuses to attend therapy or refuses to take medication?
I'm looking at you.
I don't feel if someone else has ideas right now. But I think that is a really challenging situation that is, you know, pretty common, that it comes up frequently. I think first, like, validating them, so we're, like, really listening and understanding where the teen is coming from is, like, a first step, because it's going to just go better if the teen feels like they're being heard by you versus you're coming in and you're saying, you have to do this, but instead really hearing out what their concerns are about medication or about therapy as a starting place, I think is really important. And then I think it can be really helpful to see, is the teen open to like just starting to meet with a therapist, just mm-hmm. for a one time, like, okay, we're just gonna go do a meet and greet and kind of get going in that way. And the therapist can then approach it from trying to really build a relationship with the teen and building the therapeutic alliance. Those would be my thoughts.
I think it's really important to normalize it.
Yeah.
That most people at some point in their lives do need therapy. And pointing that out, at least 25 to 50% of us throughout our lifetime suffer from anxiety or depression. And so it's very normal to say, you know what, a lot of us need help just talking with someone. If you would give it a try, that's great. And also letting them know that they may not click with the first person that they meet. Like Meg said, have a meet and greet. Some of your children love one teacher and some of them hate them. And so sometimes it's almost like a dating game, so they can find somebody that they can personally connect with, that they can build a trusting relationship with. And then also making sure that you're establishing that confidentiality. So your teen knows, and hopefully their clinician is a very good therapist who can say, most of what is said in this room is kept confidential unless you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else. And so they know that they will be trusted with some of their worries, so it's not shared necessarily with their parents if it's not needed to. And that's a really important piece.
Yeah. In addition to all these wonderful thoughts, I also would say look for other pro-social activities your teen might be involved with. I know there's a lot of great groups that have some therapeutic aspects but are not necessarily a therapy group. I'm thinking of some at the Neutral Zone, you know, especially for LGBTQ youth. There's Riot Youth there, but there's many other groups like that. Also, in terms of, we were talking about earlier about modeling, if you have not also explored therapy options for yourself and you think that might be a contributing factor, or you just, again, if your teenager sees you going to therapy, they might be more likely to go as well. And you can talk about your experiences, whatever you're willing to share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great points. Sometimes along with what everyone has said, if you find a good therapist or a good psychiatrist that might say something like, well, I'll reserve this, you know, 4 to 5 p.m. time slot on Thursday. You can come if you want. You know, that's hard to find first and foremost. But finding somebody who's willing to meet your teen where they're at, whether that's emotionally or where they're physically located, can be helpful. And like everyone has said, it's super, super common. My guess is your teen or the teen that you're concerned about probably has a friend who has gone to therapy. And maybe that friend might be your little in. The next question is how to break a bad cycle. And I would interpret this as how to break a bad kind of thought spiral cycle. But yeah.
Yeah, so I think with breaking a bad thought spiral cycle, I think that can be really challenging because we can all get stuck in like worry thoughts or negative thoughts. I think one approach that I find helpful that's kind of from a DBT approach is the idea of checking the facts, you know, which I think what Lindsay talked about as well, just really looking at, you know, what the thought is and does that fit the facts. Like, say if I had a coworker that came in and, like, threw their books down on the table and was like, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, they're really mad at me, I did something wrong, to really stop and, like, look at the situation. I'm like, okay, what else is going on with that coworker? And really step back and try to check the facts of the situation. And that can really help. I also find that breathing can really help in the moment with kind of stopping a cycle. Maybe you can't get yourself completely out of the thoughts, but just taking a moment to do some deep breathing and even counting your breath can really help just kind of take a step back in the moment.
I tend, when I see clients clinically and they might be really upset about something, a lot of times I use guided imagery. So we focus really on the here and now. Tell me where your happy place is, what would be a perfect day for you. We talk through it, I turn down the lights, and we're calm. And then once they're calmed down, then we can talk about things a little bit. And just nodding your head and being present. I think one of the most important things is being present at all times. As Lindsay said, the listening. Just listen. I know it's hard to not want to speak, but just to listen, to sit, to be calm. And I think also teens pick up on our own anxieties and are wanting to fix things. If you can sit and be still, breathe with them, sit with them, eat with them, those are really, really important things. Play a card game. Say, you know what, you're not ready to talk right now, but do you want to play a game of cards? Do you want me to make you a cup of coffee? I do that. I know Lindsay's going to be mad at me saying, no, that's bad for sleep.
You can have coffee in the morning, just not 6 to 8 hours before bed.
Or finding something mutual with your teen. Lindsay said, find something that they might enjoy doing. With my teenager, who sometimes I struggle with, no, I'm the perfect mom, I say, let's go get our nails done, or let's just go to Starbucks. And it's just some alone time, or let's go for a walk together. And it's just a time to connect.
Another thing I like to do in the downward spiral is sometimes it seems like a really long way from the highly negative thoughts they're having. So I offer, a neutral thought, even if they feel like it's a long way to very positive thoughts. And especially a lot of teens feel like, you know, the positive thoughts are kind of that Pollyanna-ish, like everything's great, everything's wonderful. And they're like, you know, honestly, it's not great, it's not wonderful. So I offer a neutral thought, like instead of like everything's going to be bad today, you know, I'd be like, maybe one thing good might happen today, you know, just kind of those baby steps along that route.
So the next question kind of piggybacks off of a few things that you guys had mentioned in terms of the deep breathing and staying with somebody. So the question is, will biofeedback or neurofeedback help with depression?
I think it certainly could.
Yes.
I think feelings sometimes present in physical ways as well. So one of the other things I know, which is a very poor coping skill, is self-injury. And it's very, very common in teens. So that might be something as a parent that you've heard of or maybe seen or experienced. And so working with that type of feedback and knowing how to react with it, it could be helpful.
Staying on that kind of path, talking about chemical imbalances in the brain, and how does medication help or harm somebody who has a depressed brain?
One of the most common classes of medications used in teenagers that is proven to be effective is SSRIs. And so there is a chemical in our brain that's responsible for elevated mood. It's called serotonin. And so certain medicines can help elevate the amount of the availability of this chemical in their brains, and it seems to help really well. It can also use other chemicals and stimulate neurotransmitters. What we know about medication is it works really good with therapy. And so there's not a magic fix. The other thing here, these are long-term medications. So typically the initial trial is 6 to 9 months, and they're adjusted and titrated. The other thing is humans are very different. So what might work for one teen might not be the same dose for another teen. You might need to change to a different medicine because we all respond differently. And over time, if we learn that our metabolisms and the chemical reactions in our body act very differently. So and our genetics, believe it or not, act differently with the medications that we take. So sometimes it's trial and error and to see what works. The other thing to be very mindful of is if you do decide to have a trial of medication, that you don't withdraw it without talking to a medical professional, because a lot of times the withdrawal symptoms can be very, very uncomfortable. One of the most common mistakes is medications typically take 4 to 6 weeks to see any difference at all. And what will happen is clients will go, oh my gosh, I don't need this. I'm doing great. Why did I ever start this? And then they stop. And so that's one of the things that I always counsel people on. Remember, when I see you in a month, you might feel great. I want to make sure that you still come see me and you don't stop your medication. Even family and friends, I'm like, did you stop your medication? They're like, how did you know? Because you've had a headache for 3 days and you're a little bit irritable, but it does happen.
Yeah, and so I'm not a prescribing provider, I'm a social worker. But what I often say to the folks who are in my office who may benefit from a medication is that it's like any other chronic health condition. If you had something like diabetes, you would be making sure that you're checking your blood sugar levels, you're eating well, you're getting good sleep, and you're exercising, and maybe all of that's working, but we could use a little bit more help, and then that's when we added some medication. It's the same thing with mental illness. Maybe you are doing your CBT, you are exercising, you're working really hard on incorporating positive activities into your life, and you're still not feeling great, that may be a good time to talk to your primary care provider or psychiatrist about medication.
And I would also make sure that you or your teen is being evaluated for any other medical conditions that might be going on. Sometimes thyroid disorders or vitamin D deficiencies can also play a really contributing role to some of their symptoms.
And I would also add that if someone is unsure about starting medication, that it can be really helpful to meet with a psychiatrist or doctor and just talk through your concerns with them, because that can be a really good just starting point if you have concerns about side effects or different things, to really be able to communicate and hear about that rather than kind of just waiting. So.
And sometimes medications as benign as melatonin can be very, very helpful for teenagers, just to help regulate their sleep. And sometimes that's all you need to get them on the right track.
How do you differentiate between ADHD and depression, and the follow-up to that is how common is a dual diagnosis or comorbidity of ADHD and depression? Does treatment look different for that?
You can treat both at the same time. What's really important about ADHD when you're diagnosing is you're making sure that you're having an evaluation in different settings. So a medical provider should make sure that they're looking at a parent's perspective or their guardian. How are they presenting at home? And there's certain tools and symptom checklists, Connors, Vanderbilts, to name a few, that parents do, but also getting that information from somebody else in a different setting. So what is some of their teachers saying? What does that look like, and how does it compare? One of the most important things to make sure is that it's seen in more than one setting. So parent report versus teacher report. We want to make sure that it's the same thing, because sometimes it's more a behavior-parent interaction with how they're acting at home, or it might be one particular teacher, but overall in 5 out of the 6 classes, you're not seeing those symptoms. So that is the first thing, to make sure that that's occurring and that they're being followed up and measured over time if you decide to choose treatment for the ADHD. Depression can co-occur a lot. And so there are different types of medicines and classes that can work for both. Sometimes one medication is enough, and sometimes it's a combination of the medicines. But like I said, each student and child is individual, so there might be a couple different treatment options to try.
And ADHD is often a little bit more comorbid with anxiety than depression, but since we know that anxiety and depression tend to go together, it makes sense that they would all go together a little bit.
And just monitoring for side effects of some of the ADHD medications, because they can interfere with sleep. Mm-hmm. So sometimes your medical professional might pick something that's more shorter acting than longer acting if they notice impairment in sleep, sometimes eating habits as well, because it tends to decrease appetite in some of the medications.
Do you think a teen who participates in risky sexual behaviors is a sign or symptom of depression?
So I think this can be a sign or symptom of depression. In fact, it's one of the ones we talk about in the play that we bring out to schools. The young person who's depressed decides to engage in some risky sexual behavior. But it's not always, you know, it definitely can be a sign of impulsiveness, ADHD, like we were talking about before. But it has to do, I think, with some of that sense of self-worth, some of the need to be validated in whatever way possible, and sometimes being validated in a sexual or even a loving relationship can feel really good, even if it is exploitative.
I think you have to recognize that exploring sexual behavior is a part of normal teenage development and transition into adulthood. So normalizing that at first and realizing it may not be depression, it just might be an adolescent. The other thing sometimes is depressed people have more sex because of the hormone releases that happen in their body. So that might be the one thing that they do to feel good, not only from an emotional standpoint, but a physical standpoint as well.
How does treatment for social anxiety induced depression different from major depression treatment? So it sounds like anxiety comorbid with depression versus straight major depression. How does the treatment look different for those?
I would say it's not that different.
With social anxiety, you're doing a little bit more exposure, so putting people in a situation that normally might be a little bit uncomfortable at these different tiered levels, slowly getting that person to warm up to being in that situation. With depression, you may have a little bit of exposure if they've been isolating themselves for a long time, if they've kind of pulled back from some of their activities. But typically, cognitive behavioral therapy is going to be the root for both. You just might have a little bit more exposure with social anxiety.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. So, yeah, just CBT with both, but more exposure focused with the social anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm actually seeing a lot is isolating yourself. And I still haven't quite got it straight in my mind whether you're still isolating yourself if you only talk to people online. And they might be your school friends. They might be people you met through different identity groups. But I'm still coming to terms with whether that's isolating. I'd be interested to hear what the other panelists think about that. But I do believe that that person-to-person, look someone in the eye, being able to touch them on the shoulder, being able to hug them is an important part of social interaction. But I'm willing to be proven wrong.
I would agree with you. I was actually doing some research for social media and how it impacts our mental health. And there's a lot of relationships between social media usage and depression, though not necessarily cause and effect. So there's a couple of things that might increase somebody's risk for depression when they're using social media. One is how many different social media platforms they're on. The more social media platforms are, the more likely they are to have symptoms of depression. The thought behind this is, like you were saying, you might find this group of people that you click with, but each social media platform is a little bit different enough from the other one to make transitioning from one platform to another difficult. So it might be that you're trying to seek reassurance and you're trying to fit in one place. So maybe people who are a little bit more prone to depression tend to pick up on more of those. And what we also have seen a relationship between is Facebook usage and depression. So the more often somebody is on Facebook, the more likely they may have symptoms of depression. So not cause and effect, but often some definite relationships there. So I would agree that online connection is so beneficial, especially if you're in an area that's a little bit more rural or if you're part of a marginalized population. It can be so important to find like-minded individuals. And on the same token, or on the flip side, I guess, it's so important to just talk to people face-to-face or even on the phone, FaceTime. Just, yeah, that talking is really important.
The other concern is a lot of social media or online websites encourage poor coping skills or poor behaviors. So if, when I'm working with teens or hear of teens that have eating disorders, there are actual websites where people are buddies and they're eating disorder buddies and they encourage each other to not eat or have poor coping skills. The same goes for cutting and really really maladaptive behaviors. And so these teens kind of cling to each other and support each other's really bad coping skills. Yeah. And that can be very scary and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I love to mention about Facebook is when we talked about social comparison, like that is a great tool for comparing yourself to others and oftentimes coming up short because people are very cognizant of what they post on Facebook, and it's not, you know, usually a negative thing. It's more presenting yourself in a very positive light. So a young person will be on Facebook, maybe they're home by themselves, and they're like, oh, my friends are all out doing these wonderful, great things, and I'm not, so...
It's a curated version of life, yes, for sure. And the other thing along with that is that, you know, 20 years ago, all those kind of images of these beautiful people doing amazing things were all celebrities or models. And now it's our neighbor next door that, you know, has the perfect filter and angle and light and shoes or whatever. So those discrepancies are really tough as well. All right, so this is also a good question for the group. Two-part, local treatment options for low-income teens, mm-hmm. and then local treatment options for teens with parents who aren't on board with treatment. So we're all like...
Yeah, so I think I can start and we can piggyback, but for low-income teens, I think a lot of it first depends on like insurance if you have Medicaid, mm-hmm. would be, and I know community mental health is like one option for Medicaid, and there are other clinics in the area that accept Medicaid as well. So like I think some examples are Catholic Charities, the Rachel Upjohn Building at University of Michigan, our organization, Regional Alliance for Healthy Schools, which is school-based treatment as well. I think those are some examples, and I think those places all offer both therapy and medication management as well.
If anyone is ever uninsured, we can always assist in helping them enroll in insurance if they're eligible for that. And we're fortunate to have a county health plan as well for some students that may be eligible and family members. For teens, by state law, teens can self-consent for some social work services on a limited basis at the age of 14. And it's a limited amount of treatment sessions. I believe it's 12. But they can self-consent and refer on their own so they can start those therapy sessions. And many times if they see a therapist over time when they build a relationship with their therapist, they can encourage to be talked with their parents. They may maybe have a group treatment, and then the family can move forward in helping the child do better.
Yeah, so it's 12 sessions or up to 4 months of treatment is the maximum. And that includes therapy but not medication management because you need parent consent for that. So.
And if you are insured, if you always flip over your card, if for a non-Medicaid plan, it says for mental health services, please call. So many of the HMOs have affiliates with certain agencies, and they can tell you where you can use your benefits for those type of services. The other thing is mental health concerns are so common that primary care providers are treating them as well. Mm-hmm. So when you're taking your teen for their annual physical or their sports physical, that's something that should be included in that. How are you doing? Do you feel sad or down? Do you feel as you have nothing to look forward to? Those are all really important things as a primary care clinician that they should be asked, and we should be asking, knowing what the incidence is.
I actually thanked my doctor last time I was in there when they asked me about depression. I was like, nice job. But I also wanted to make sure I plugged the Corner Health Center. We exist to help low-income young people get the services they need. So my basic spiel is that, you know, we will never turn anyone away because they can't pay for their services. And I know a lot of other clinics exist that do that. That's why we exist. That's part of our mission. We want to make sure that any young person can access services. So again, we take Medicaid, we take many other insurances, we'll help people apply for Medicaid. But we will always see someone if they come to us in need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many great organizations in Washtenaw County that can help. There's a few of them represented here. With the ACA, most Medicaid and Medicaid HMOs cover 20 behavioral health visits per calendar year. So most people who have an insurance like that are in good shape. And then the other thing is that there are schools of social work and schools of counseling in the area. So you are able to get services from students who are in graduate school. They're usually at low or no cost.
Is it? All right. Thank you all.